The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Tuesday, the 8th of June, 2021. On the podcast today, Dr. Adam Hill, CEO of Oncommune, discusses their trading update for 2021, which showed an 8-fold increase in revenue on 2020, and also discusses a strong outlook for 2022. Plus, Jason Tebb, CEO, and Clive Beattie, CFO of On The Market, discuss their full year results, in which they experienced double-digit percentage top-line growth and profitability despite COVID. Plus, Paul Hayward, Chief Executive Officer of Block Energy, provides an end-of-year operational update and points to the milestones to come. And Nick Lee, Investment Director at Riverfort Global Opportunities, talks through their full year results, in which they recorded a second profitable year and commenced the payment of a dividend. Plus, Glenn Goodman, former ITV news business correspondent and the author of The Crypto Trader. In fact, we argue on today's podcast about lots of things, and we also agree on lots of things, but we start off with an argument about investors versus traders. Plus, on the podcast, at the end of the podcast, I have two lists for you: the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most read RNSs. You can check out these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
Hello and welcome to Vox Markets. Today I'm joined by Adam Hill, who's CEO at Oncommune. How are you today, Adam?
Very good, thanks, Zach. And you?
I'm doing fine. I understand you've had a busy year. You've just released your trading update for full year 2021 this morning. Can you summarise the highlights as far as you're concerned?
More than happy to. So it's been a very successful year, despite the backdrop of the pandemic, which, of course, we have in part been responding to. And key, I think, is in many minds will be whether we've been able to hit market consensus. And indeed, we have. We've delivered about £5.6 million worth of revenue in line with consensus, and an 8-fold increase on last year's takings. In addition, we've been delivering a fairly aggressive cost reduction program, and so equally costs are in line with market expectation. And throughout the year, there has been driving much of that growth a slew of very important contracts on the ImmunoInsight side of our business.
Right, you had the successful oversubscribed fundraise in March. What are the proceeds being used for as far as that raise was concerned?
Well, the ImmunoInsights business has seen a substantial amount of interest from our pharma and biotech clients, which has meant that we've had to consider increasing the capacity of our Dortmund facility, which delivers much of that business over the last 6 months. The fundraise, which was very successful, we did it at a premium. We raised 9 million, is entirely focused on increasing capacity from last year's capacity to four times that by the beginning of next year to meet the demand that we're now seeing in our pipeline.
One of the interesting aspects of your business is how you can convert, or how it's possible to convert, service contracts into strategic commercial partnerships. Could you run us through that?
Yeah, absolutely. We receive samples through the door. We charge just over €1,000 a sample to analyze those samples and return a report. It's often hundreds, if not thousands, of samples we receive from each of our customers. And that report presents them with some insights, some immuno insights, which we believe is important to their business. It is foreground intellectual property, obviously developed over the background that protects our platform technology. And it's that foreground intellectual property which we continue to own the rights own the rights to. Of course, as we deepen our relationship with those pharmaceutical customers, we look to be able to license them access to that foreground intellectual property at a point in time, so that it can continue to add value to their business.
Obviously, it's been a busy year, as we've hinted at before. What are the upcoming news flow and inflection points that we can look forward to from Oncoimmune in the next few months?
We're facing down a really very busy Q1. Clearly, we have already experienced the first week of that, and the team are up and about winning business. The Immuno Insights business is going to continue to drive much of the aggressive growth that we have pegged by the analysts in for this year. But I hope that you're going to be able to see a good chunk of that in Q1. So more pharma contracts, more biotech contracts, and very much like the Cedars-Sinai contracts that we've been signing over the last 6 months, we hope to continue to see interest from large academic health science centers that are prosecuting, delivering those clinical trials on behalf of pharma sponsors.
Adam Hill, CEO at Oncoimmune, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for your time, Zach.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Jason Tebb, CEO, Clive Beattie, CFO of On The Market, OTMP. Sticker there, guys. Thanks for joining me.
Pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning, yeah.
Yeah, it's a big day. Full year results out for 12 months ended the 31st of January 2021. And it's been a very eventful year, so 6 months for the market and real estate. And Jason, of course, you've been in the job for how long now?
6 months now.
6 months, there we are, and so lots going on. So before we delve into the targets and the figures and all that stuff, just give us a brief overview of what On The Market's all about, if you could, Jason.
Of course, onthemarket.com is a property marketplace, sometimes referred to as a property portal, and that's where estate agents, letting agents and house builders advertise their available properties across the country, and then we introduce them to consumers who visit the site to search for those properties of interest and engage directly with those advertisers.
Excellent stuff. Okay, full year results out. Looking positive, showing the business is definitely moving in the right direction. And of course, we've got two parts of you here. We've got you, CEO, we can talk about the operations, and Clive on the financials. But you must be pleased with these, Jason, yeah?
Yeah, I'm really pleased, Justin, really pleased. Delighted to be reporting a strong performance in my first set of results. And despite the really tough conditions that every business really has faced during the pandemic, we've continued to grow their business and achieve profitability, which gives us a really solid platform for the future. And our key performance indicators are all showing year-on-year increases. Average advertisers are up, average leads per advertiser are up, site visits are up, the number of new homes developers are all up year-on-year. And I think that demonstrates that the business is growing and self-sustainable, and that's supported by our financials too.
Yeah, Clive, let's talk about the financials.
Absolutely. So again, very happy with the financials in what were obviously very testing circumstances. So, you know, the headlines are good. We've increased revenues. They're up 22%. But that doesn't reflect the fact that we gave direct discounts to our customers of 2.6 million, where we needed to help them in the first lockdown when life was very tough for an estate agent. And we also curtailed our conversion activity. So we didn't seek to change people from free contracts onto paying contracts. So despite all that, we very pleased to have a 22% increase in revenues up to 23 million. We did then take various mitigating actions to look after our own position. We reduced our cost base, and I think we had some very prudent cost management during the process. In particular, our marketing we reduced, but actually, we're very pleased there. Our marketing was about half the year before, around 6 million. But notwithstanding that, you've heard from Jason the very strong operational metrics we delivered around visits and around leads back to our advertisers. And I think that says to us that we are very well entrenched with the active property seekers who are actually looking to contact agents to actually do deals. So that was very good for us. And then finally, I'd just say, our balance sheet strength, we were very happy with. We managed to conserve our cash. Indeed, our cash at year end increased 2 million up to 10.7 million from the end of January 20, which in itself was a very good performance in the period. So, very happy, strong performance in what we think were very challenging circumstances.
Yeah, and of course, it's a historic result. So let's look forward, as the stock market often does. And so what's your strategy then for the business going forward? And how do you plan to continue the growth then? What's the key areas here, Jason?
Well, I think we've got a proven business model now, which is the classified advertising part of the business, which is showing that we're more than just a challenger now, but a viable alternative for agents, house builders, and for consumers as well. But going forwards, strategically, we will become more than just a portal and provide a suite of additional products, services, functionality to agents and house builders, but provide additional value to our offering and help us differentiate from our competitors. And we're going to focus on four key things. Everything will, of course, be based around the portal on themarket.com. And we'll be producing a suite of upgrades to products and functionality, some of which we've done in the last couple of weeks. We're also going to be developing our software strategy. And you'll remember that recently we announced the acquisition of Glanty, and that fits nicely within that pillar. We're also going to be focusing on data and market intelligence, because both customers, our agents, and consumers are telling us they want access to more data. They want more transparency in the transaction process. So we'll be helping to fulfill that. And the last thing we'll do is focus on communications and marketing tools. Our relationship with Reach PLC, which we announced a couple of months ago, is all geared around supporting agents locally as well as nationally. And I think also after the pandemic, the concept and the way that people search for property is changing, moving away from just physical to physical and virtual, and we'll hope to support that too. And I think that means these four pillars help us on what we will be doing, which is delivering an ambitious roadmap of those developments over the coming months.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's talk about current trading. I've noticed more headlines about house prices leapt another 9.5% in the year to May. And how's current trading at the moment?
Well, perhaps if I start just on the financial side, and then Jason can add on operationally. So we've had a positive start to the current year, FY22, for us. Everything in line with expectations. And actually, I'd probably highlight, we actually made a profit after tax in the year we're reporting on, the year to January 21. We made a 2.7 million profit after tax. And I've already touched on our balance sheet and the strengthening of the cash position there. And I think those have given us a lot of confidence. So we're doing a couple more things. We've decided to repay in full the coronavirus job retention scheme grants that we took. We took to protect our employees and avoid redundancies and the right reasons. But I think now, with the benefit of hindsight and how we've come out through the year, we're going to be repaying those. So I think that's the right thing to do, and it's positive for us. But also, I think we have a pretty reasonable expectation now that the cash we have is sufficient to support the group as we go forward and execute our strategy. That probably wouldn't be the case if we found a material acquisition to do. That would have to be a one-off and something that we identified as in the interest of shareholders. But otherwise, I think we should be okay with the resources we've got. Having made that profit in financial year 21, we can now invest further in the business, in staff, in the team, but also, of course, in a normalised marketing spend and putting that back to normal, as we have done since the beginning of this year, and all that without really damaging our foreseeable prospects. So, a good start to the year.
Mm-hmm. And I think, just to add to that, it's we're now seeing the fruits of all the hard work that had been done during the first 6 months of my tenure. The team have done a fantastic job. We're now onboarding new estate agents all the time. Hundreds of agents have joined us this financial year, and we've brought on hundreds of new homes developments as well. So we're developing our advertiser numbers, we're increasing our product offering, and we're starting to deliver that clear differentiation, which I think is really important for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, if someone has been reading your financial results and are listening right now, likes the sound of the progress you're making here, but are not yet following the story, give them those three quick reasons, Jason, if you could, why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add On the Market to their watch list, please.
Of course, Justin. So the first reason is, as you've already heard, we've displayed strong growth in both the key metrics and in our financial position. Not only are we seeing growing consumer awareness and visitor numbers, but we're in a stronger cash position year on year and have got increasing revenues, as we've just reported, which means we can now invest in people and products, but all within the framework of a prudent cost management structure. Secondly, we've started an exciting new phase of our growth with this really ambitious roadmap, which we'll see On the Market become more than just a property portal, with a suite of new products and services, many of which are revenue generating. And thirdly, as indicated before, we have a differentiated proposition and from other businesses in this vertical, where our agents support us with new and exclusive properties that are either listed 24 hours before Rightmove or Zoopla, or indeed aren't available on any property search sites at all. And we're now developing further areas of differentiation to give serious property seekers an advantage in their search.
Excellent stuff. Jason Clive, thanks very much for catching up, and Alex, hopefully we'll catch up again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
Hello and welcome to Vox Markets. Today I'm joined by Paul Hayward, as the CEO of Block Energy. How are you today, Paul?
I'm very well, thanks, Zach. Thanks for having me.
I can tell by the fantastic broadband that you've got that you're obviously not in the UK.
No, that's right. I'm at our operating base. I'm out here in Georgia and Lilo, working with the team and getting prepared for drilling. So, got out in Georgia last week, and it's been a busy time since landing. But it's an exciting time for the company at the moment, as I'm sure our followers will already be aware.
And you were allowed out as well, which is, I don't know if it's green, amber or red, but you were allowed out too. So what's not to like? But quite a lot of news flow just to start June. What are the highlights for you from your perspective?
Yeah, I certainly think, you know, drilling activity is a clear highlight. That follows a fundraise back end of last year. Preparation for drilling is a key event, and it's something the entire team's currently focused on, of course. And most recently, we had our annual accounts out, and key highlights for, I guess, 2020. The obvious one to point to is the acquisition with Schlumberger, of course. Clearly, that was a transformational event for the company, and one of which has seen the organization grow substantially since that transaction completed in November last year. Following that transaction, of course, there was a fundraise to fund drilling of two wells this year, and we're looking forward to kicking off our next well, Zach. So it's all hands on deck right now.
So the P word, production and spudding and all that stuff, is that on the horizon now?
Indeed. Yeah. So as our followers will also be aware, we've implemented a quarterly operational update into our communications plans to ensure that everybody's kept up to speed with baseline production performance and, of course, a performance against plan with regards to drilling X wells, etc. Next quarterly update will be out, I expect, back end of June, moving into July, alongside, all things being well, spudding of our next well, which was the plan announced back in Q1, of course. So, it's an active period.
And for people who are not familiar with your company, presumably with Schlumberger involved, this thing is reasonably significant. It's not going to be just a little bit of a tiny little a bit of oil there. Is it a significant resource that you're sitting on?
Absolutely. I think across the, that transaction alone increased our reserve base by a factor of 60 times. Our 2P reserve base throughout Block 11B, which was one of the assets required, is 60 million barrels. We've brought on an extra 650 odd BCF of gas. So we're now sitting in it above 1.2 TCF of gas resources across West Rostarvin 11B. So there really is lots to play for. We've got healthy life on the production sharing contracts. It gives us enough time to get after these reserves and resources. And we look to be starting that plan sometime this month, Zach. So
is it a case of like wait and see and just see what you come up with?
I would certainly say, keep your eyes peeled for our spud dates and drilling of the next well, of course. I mean, this will be the first new well that the company has drilled off the back of acquiring new 3D seismic and really moving through what is seen to be internally as a bit of a step change in terms of building our technical capacity and resources to truly understand the Middle Eocene reservoir, which is, of course, the reservoir we'll be drilling, targeting with our next well. We've moved away from the kind of low cost and somewhat limited technology with our drilling focus. And we are certainly now moving into a somewhat silver plated work program, which kicks off in West Rostavi. So keep your eyes peeled for this event. I think it'll be an exciting one.
Right. I mean, it's clearly an inflection point for the company. And I think the last time we spoke was maybe a couple of years ago. So, you're a long way down the line now. Are you pleased? Well, I presume you're pleased that the oil price is nudging $70 a barrel as well. So obviously it's been all over the place.
Zach, you're absolutely right. And it's, you know, it's an event we certainly couldn't, I don't think anybody called 12 months back. You know, there's lots of views being cast, and I don't think anybody saw $70 Brent, that's for sure. So very, very happy at these levels. I mean, our projects work very well at $35-40 Brent. So there's lots of headroom at 70 and, you know, a welcome boost to cash flow, that's for sure.
And when will that be hitting the sort of the coffers? Is it immediately? Is it, you know, is it over the summer and going to the tail end of the year?
Yeah, on a quarterly basis, actually, Zach. So, you know, we're of course producing day to day, and we typically make our crude sales on a quarterly basis, plus or minus a month. And so therefore, you know, we expect the next oil sale to take place within the next month or two. And assuming we're at 70, we'll realize that gain immediately.
And just finally, in terms of the strategy of the company, are you always on the lookout for new assets?
We're certainly focused on mature development, and I think we have plenty on our plate in Georgia right now. You know, there's a lot of activity in Georgia with some of the mid-tiers moving in and also looking for opportunities. And, you know, Block is now the largest producer in country, sitting on one of the largest portfolios in country. So, you know, certainly interesting exploring partnerships where available, but I think right now the focus is on executing a drilling program and working out how we can tap into the remaining reserve potential, certainly throughout 11B within the time frame available to us.
Well, it's great news. I'm glad that you've made good progress since we last spoke. Paul Hayward, CEO of Block Energy, thank you very much indeed.
Zach, thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Nick Lee, Investment Director at Riverfort Global Opportunities. RGO is the ticker. Nick, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure to be here, Justin.
Now, you've just released your final results, ended 31st December 2020, almost 6 months on from that now. So it's they are historic results, of course, and we'll talk about what's happened and the outlook as well. But before we get into this, Nick, as always, if someone's listening now and not quite sure or familiar with Riverfort, can you explain the business, please?
So Riverfort is an investment company listed on AIM, and it has it's focused on investing in a range of sectors, generally into sort of the listed junior company space, and, you know, historically more through sort of structured products. So generally investment structures that have equity upside and downside protection. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what it is in a nutshell. But what we have been doing more recently, because we think it's very complementary to that sort of strategy, is to sort of look at some opportunities that are more pre-IPO type opportunities, where we see a potential listing or exit of the investment in a relatively short period of time, and in sectors that we think are very exciting and have got lots of scope for growth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a bit of a blend of the two is really what we're looking at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's first of all go through some highlights here. Should we start financial, operational? What do you want to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's our sort of second profitable year. You know, profits are significantly up. They're pretty much more than double what we achieved in 2019. We've achieved an increase in NAV, although, you know, with these sort of companies, NAV is not really that relevant, because, you know, we have a very attractive investment portfolio and there's a lot of potential in that. So, you know, at any point in time, NAV is going to, in our view, massively understate the potential value of the business. But anyway, we've still managed to grow that. We've still got a chunk of cash available for investment. We've done a bit of sort of housekeeping. We've done a capital reorganization, which has enabled us to already pay a dividend. And that's something we're going to look at doing further, you know, going forward. So, you know, it's a very sort of exciting set of results, really, and just underlying the sort of the success of the strategy, which, to be honest, we probably first look to implement a couple of years ago now. So, you know, we're very pleased to have actually implemented what we said we were going to do.
Yeah. Well, I'm just looking at the comparisons here. And quite impressive. The investment income up from sort of close to 900,000 in 2019 to 1.2 million in 2020. You got net gain from financial instruments at that's kind of massively, isn't it? From 127,000 to 1.4 million. So doing very well.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, it's just validation of our sort of sensible and sort of interesting investment strategy that has enabled us to generate these sorts of returns. And going forward, we've been pretty active in the first almost half of this year now, particularly on looking at the opportunities in the sort of the pre-IPO space. And we've made two fairly significant investments so far, one into Pluto Digital Assets, which is focused on the digital asset space, and the other one, Smart Tech 247, which is the cybersecurity business. And I mean, you know, that whole space is incredibly fast growing, and you know, Smart Tech's a great example of a very interesting investment because it's already established. You know, it's established making profits and revenue, and it's in a sector that has grown and will continue to grow quite significantly because of all the cyber security threats that are around and about at the moment.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? It's they almost fit together. And I know a lot of people blame, and it's a ridiculous claim these days, saying Bitcoin enables ransomware and all that and all this kind of stuff. But it's not the case. But you know, people used to sort of launder cash way before Bitcoin came along, and now Bitcoin, for example, digital assets are more traceable. And in fact, if the FBI have just made an arrest, haven't they, or based on this ransomware cyber attack in the US? And so they sort of fit hand in glove here, because you have got these, you know, it's a new wave of claiming money, isn't it, with digital, but also there's the digital cybersecurity side of it, which is huge, because everything, especially with the pandemic, has migrated online, hasn't it?
Yeah. And people don't realise, you know, quite what the exposure is until they get hit. And then when they get hit, they don't really know what to do with it. So, you know, Smart Tech is very interesting because it does a lot of monitoring. So if you're a client, it will monitor threats. It will provide sort of incident response. So, you know, there you are, you're the CEO of a decent sized company and suddenly you get attacked. Well, it's not something you've ever had to deal with before. What do you do? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, being able to talk to somebody like the team at Smart Tech, they're very clear as to, you know, how you behave, how you get yourself out of what is potentially a mess that could kill the business.
Yeah.
So, you know, very interesting company, I think, at this juncture in how the sort of economies are developing, and this, you know, obviously increasing move towards technology.
Yeah. Now let's talk about the digital side of it. Of course, there's been a great run, you know, as far as cryptocurrencies are concerned. We're at the moment, we're having a bit of a sell-off, a bit of a consolidation period, and I suppose that's to be expected, isn't it?
Oh, I think so. You know, it's the underlying currencies are pretty volatile. So you're going to see ebbs and flows. I mean, what's interesting, of course, is the degree of liquidity, even for some of the smaller coins. You know, it's an incredibly liquid market that is tradable 24/7. So it almost makes the stock market look a bit parochial in a funny sort of way. Yeah. But you know, it's clearly, you know, there's a lot of money that has been put into it. There's a lot of functionality within the currencies. You know, it's here to stay, and there are going to be, you know, ebbs and flows. And you know, our investment into Pluto is much more, you know, focused on the sort of technology, as opposed to, you know, sitting there just holding a bunch of crypto. You know, there's a lot more value added, and it's much more of a technology company than a holding company for a bunch of cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, what I find interesting, really, is that you have countries like China saying they're going to ban Bitcoin mining and all this stuff, but then they're setting up their own cryptocurrencies. Now the Bank of England are looking into setting up, looking at the options there. And so that really does validate, in my mind, the technology behind it all, blockchain, doesn't it?
Yeah, and you're right, your point earlier about transparency. I mean, it is amazing, you know, if you've got you know, the somebody's address, let's say, I mean, just looking at, you know, an account that I have, you know, you can see, and the whole world can see every transaction that goes through that particular account. Mm-hmm. So in terms of transactions, it's incredibly transparent.
Yeah, absolutely. And so looking forward here, you know, are you obviously looking at more investments, and are they in the same areas?
Yeah. I mean, I think we do think the technology space is pretty exciting, and we think that, you know, the sort of the opportunity. So really, we've got a sort of a complementary strategy here. We're going to continue doing what we've been doing, which is, you know, more sort of structured financings, you know, convertible debt, that sort of, or venture debt, as we tend to coin it. So we're going to be doing that because that's quite good cash flow, maybe slightly smaller ticket. And then we're looking at these interesting pre-IPO situations for the right companies, where they're an attractive company with a relatively clear path to an exit or you know, realization. You know, because I think quite a lot of investment companies tends to be a sort of a one-way street. You know, money comes in, gets invested, and then, you know, when's it going to come back? Is it 3 years, 5 years? You know, that's quite a long time, and we think there's quite an interesting sort of valuation gain to be made from a, you know, relatively advanced pre-IPO business to an actually listed business. So there's quite a good valuation arbitrage there. So we're going to be certainly looking at more opportunities in that space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, and just a quick summary, recorded a second profitable year, commenced the payment of a dividend, and the current share price is now significantly higher than the price at which new funds were raised in 2018. So what's your thoughts the rest of the year, Nick? Are you positive about the economy and
I mean where we are, I think we're pretty positive. I mean, you know, we think there's quite a lot of opportunities out there, and you know, we think the sort of the two pre-IPO businesses that we've invested in, you know, we're confident that they will you know, come to a listing in the relatively near future. And then we'll be looking at lots of other similar opportunities. So yeah, we're very, very excited for 2021, really.
Okay. All right. Well, as always, Nick, if someone's listening right now, I like the sound of where you're at, the space you're in, the progress you're making, but are not yet following the story. If you could, three bullet points as to why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add Riverfort Global Opportunities to their watch list, please.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I think we've got a great investment portfolio with lots of potential to make significant returns within the portfolio. You know, we think our strategy of combining the sort of the pre-IPO opportunities with our sort of structured fundings strategy is very, very balanced and is very attractive to public market investors.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous stuff. Nick, good to chat to you as always, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Glenn Goodman. He is the famous dirty trader.
Crypto trader.
Yeah, he trades. Trades and investments, they differ basically in time frame and loyalty, I think. Is that right? And research. Is that right? Well, how do you define, you know, what's a trader, what's an investor?
Well, the old saying goes, as one wag once put it, that
traders are dirty, investors are clean. Is that
no,
what they'll say?
Oh, no, okay. That an investment is basically, I can't remember the exact phrase, damn it.
I'm glad you got that one down.
Hold on. An investment is a trade that went wrong? Something like
no,
that?
No, that's a trader's perspective. No.
An investment is a trade.
If you want, that's just a trader.
That's something like that. Hold on. I'm going to find it. Nope, can't find the phrase.
Well, I know what you mean.
You get the idea. The idea is you're a trader. Everyone's a trader. Everyone wants to make money. And when it goes wrong and they go into loss, instead of selling it, like I always do, tell people they should do in order to avoid big losses, they hold on and thus become a long-term investor.
Yeah, no, I disagree completely with that. I think that's written from a catchy little phrase. But when I actually invest in a company, right, yeah. I look at the business and tend to invest in the business. The business has got to be...
Yeah, but you can do it. Traders do
Hang
that
on a second. Let me
people
finish.
People call themselves traders do
let
that
Let me
too.
Finish. No, they don't. They just look at the chart. They can't be bothered.
No,
they're so lazy.
No.
Oh, look at the chart. It's broken the line. I'm going to get in there. Not trend. Oh, get in there. Listen, a trader trades a stock, right? An investor invests in the business. So a trader's looking at the share price. An investor looks at the business. And that's what I do. I look at the business. And
I don't think that's a correct differentiation.
Yeah.
Look,
listen,
because so many traders
look at the price.
No,
they don't.
So many traders look at the business. They do.
If the share price...
Some don't.
Hey, in fact, how can you look at the business on crypto? There's no business on many of them. They're just memes.
Crypto is harder.
They're just memes. They're memes valued at billions and billions. They've got no business. Most of them are not generating anything at all. They're an idea, if that. So essentially, all you have is a share price. So you are trading the share price. You're trading the shares, or the price, basically. That's different, isn't it? You trade the price, you invest in the business. That's the difference.
I'd say investing or trading
is investing in the business.
When you're looking at the business, is no different really to looking at, say, an early stage AIM stock, a gold miner that's going to do some digging and has got absolutely no idea whether they're actually going to find the gold or not, but they've got a good idea of where the gold is. That's kind of how cryptocurrencies work, isn't it? They know where the gold is, they've got a good idea, and they know where they might be able to make lots of good money in the future, but we're not sure yet if they're going to, blah, blah, blah. Having said that, though, some cryptocurrencies, like Ethereum being, you know, one of the most established, huge amounts are made in fees for the miners and all the rest of it, you know, and not the miner, but, you know, huge amounts are made in fees, right? Paid gas, you might have heard the word gas.
Yeah, a lot of gas.
Paid on Ethereum transactions.
A lot of gas came at the wrong hole.
Now, okay, that does not equate to revenue.
No, listen,
or
I believe
not in the traditional sense, but it shows that in a sense, Ethereum is a going concern.
Yes, no, listen, I believe in Ethereum. There are certain other things like Cardano and all that stuff. You know, they have long term prospects because we are heading towards this decentralized crypto version. And so I understand that, but many of them. No, listen to this. So essentially, when you're trading, you completely look at the share price. Alone, the movement in the price, that's all. And you base your decisions on that, pretty much. Investing, you don't. If the share price dips, you don't care too much. In fact, the business has just become cheaper as long as the business is still improving fundamentally. So, and I think you can make... To get truly rich, you have to be an investor. Traders, very few traders get rich. Most of them just blow up their accounts, you know.
Yeah, but I think the distinction is artificial, to be honest.
No, let me say one thing.
I really do. I think we get too hung up on the terminology.
I don't, because I see people. I see people all the time doing it completely wrong, as I did when I started off. I was jumping in.
Let me finish.
Because I had no faith in my research because I didn't know how to research. So you have to learn how to research a business, and that means looking at the fundamentals. I mean, you know, the balance sheet, you know, the cash flow statement, obviously the profit and loss, understanding the operations and all that stuff, and looking at different parts of the business to understand it. And so it takes a while to have. Confidence of conviction in your. So I've seen you know many an investor jump in, then the share price goes down. They start to worry. Confirmation bias happens. They think, oh, something's got to be going wrong. The share price is going down. Often not. There's nothing going wrong. So they jump out based on the share price. Now that's a trader. Now if you look in the business improving, don't worry too much about the share price. Because the business is improving. Sooner or later, it'll reflect.
You shouldn't worry about the share price.
Unless you have cast iron proof that the
basic situation is improving.
Never.
Because don't forget, 9 times out of 10, you don't know the real situation in the company.
Where are you getting these stats from? Show me this.
Because you're only going from their previous statement, whenever that was.
Yeah,
what,
I know.
3 months earlier or whatever was the last time that the company said anything.
Yeah, how much?
3 months, even as much as 6 months earlier.
That's all right.
It might be the last time that you heard anything from them. And in the meantime, everything's going tits up.
It's not. No. That's what you think as a trader. Oh, the share price is going down. Everything's going tits up. Oh!
And the whole point about share price
movements is
that quite often they're your early warning signal. right?
No,
they
they're
tell
not.
You that something's
Never.
Going wrong because the insiders are selling.
No, no.
Right? The insiders are selling before you get to find out what the truth is and what's going on.
Absolute nonsense. Insiders.
Oh,
right, you point to me all the situations that happens on a daily basis where insiders are selling because they'd be locked up. That doesn't happen. It happens once in a blue moon. Doesn't happen at all. Most businesses, you know, apart from the, you know, resource companies that basically have things in the ground in Africa somewhere, and they say, we've got lots of stuff in the ground, we're going to get it out sometime. Businesses that are generating revenue, I mean, that they are actually making money, starting to generate, you know, real cash flow from their businesses, they don't have insiders selling. On a bit of bad news.
All the time. What are you talking about? Because you've got the revenues, right? They might be growing. The revenues might be fine.
Give me an example of insider selling.
It doesn't take much of a problem for profits to start coming under fire. All right, here's an example. COVID-19 comes along, right? Loads of great revenue-generating companies. Suddenly their profits vanish in the blink of an eye.
Yeah, but that's not... I'm talking about a good long-term trend.
Yeah, well, let's say COVID-19 lasted longer than a year or two.
It has.
You know, I'm just saying...
Where's the insiders selling?
Vanish very quickly, and they don't necessarily come back. And quite often, you don't know about that because the company doesn't tell you. You're waiting for a warning sign. The
insiders.
Warning sign comes through in a sliding share price. It starts to slide slowly, and at a certain point, I will decide.
I know what's
this chart
here.
Doesn't look right anymore. There's something wrong. You know what I mean? It's like
no. This chart doesn't look right.
Look, charts always have their ups and downs, right? You have, you know, that's normal. Normal price behavior is to go up two steps and then down one step and then up two steps and down one step. That's perfectly fine. But you know as well as I do that sometimes you're looking at the chart.
No, don't say that. I don't know as well as you do.
All right, hold on. You're looking at the chart sometimes.
I know more than you do.
And you look at the way the price is moving and you think to yourself, that doesn't look right. I don't like the way that's acting. That's not doing the normal two steps up, one step down, or whatever the normal pattern of that share is. There's something wrong here. That is often a first warning signal for me. Not necessarily a warning that I should sell straight away, but certainly it makes my... If I had some kind of rabbit's ears, they'd prick up at that point, right? I'd be paying attention.
I think you are a magical rabbit.
I'd pay closer attention.
From
and
Wonderland.
At some point, I might, if it carries on sliding and it still looks worrying, I might decide to sell at some point. And I wish I had examples in front of me right now. I can dig them up.
Yeah,
if I
wish
had,
you did as well. Do you know what, though?
You are to have a look at past examples. But you know as well as I that quite often a small slide begins, it looks a little bit worrying, and then you get the plummet. Like maybe even months down the line, or sometimes days or weeks. But the point is, it's often an early
hang on, let me say one
when
thing
the share
here.
Price starts to turn around at the top and, you know, form a rounding top and then just kind of start sliding.
Yeah, but that's on like crypto and stuff, you know?
No, it's not everything. It's on shares.
Listen, let me say one thing. Do you know what mad people, right? People who are insane don't know they're insane. That's why they're insane. Okay, now you are speaking from a trader's bias. You're a trader, all right?
I'm not.
The more I look at charts, The more I look at charts, right, the less faith I put in them as far as an investment is concerned. Because I've seen stocks charts come down, turn over, and people have sold up because the chart is looking, the share price is going down. Let's sell everything. Something's going wrong, and all of a sudden the share price goes nuts based on good updates. I've seen it so many times. And of course, when a share price is going down, you worry a bit because if you're holding that stock, then the value of, you know, your paper investment is going down. But I've seen it so many times turn around on the fundamentals. Fundamentals smash technicals every day of the week. I used to do a daily chart podcast with a lady called Nicola Duke, very good chartist, and the setups look good, and all of a sudden, fundamentals come out and smash the chart apart, and it make no sense. And think, oh, okay, that doesn't make sense. So as an investor... If you're investing in a business, and I'm talking about a business now, not. And if you look at what I look at, I've got sort of nine filters. One of those filters is, you know, a long-term trend. And I'm not, the sector is in. I'm not talking about, you know, short-term or mid-term pop and drop trend, like a COVID testing stock, which, let's be honest, is a limited time. And that's what you need. When you get recurring revenue on a company, you have foresight. You can see, you know, 2-3 years down the line. Pretty much. So that's what you need. I'm not talking about three months.
Let me give you an example. All right. I'll give you an example because I've suddenly thought of one off the top of my head. It was about 10 years ago.
10 years ago? Right, let's move on. Let's talk about crypto now. 10 years ago. You got one example. Nice to see us current then. You see this happening every day.
It's a good example.
Of 10 years ago.
Yeah, but that's one that's stuck in my head. All right, from...
You just defeated your case.
It doesn't matter if I said 10 years ago. I could have said 1 month ago.
Yeah, but you haven't got it.
It's not relevant to the story.
The example sticks out in your head. It's 10 years old. That just shows you something.
Do you want to listen to the story or not?
No. Right. Let's move on to Bitcoin news.
It's a great story. Right. Okay, so I was at a party. You know, I was boogieing on
down. That shows how old it is. What was it? Your eighth birthday party?
I was, I met this guy, right? And he was a hedge fund manager. Right? Or actually, no, a fund manager, not even a hedge fund manager.
Listen, we better not go down this route. We can't go down this route.
Very rich, pillar of the establishment, right?
And it undermines your argument.
No, listen. A very, very sensible guy, had all the best education in the world, you know, very, very clever. And I was chatting to him about shares and so on. He obviously was very skeptical about me at the beginning because, you know, I said I'm a trader or whatever. He's like, yeah, you know, he obviously looked down his nose at me initially, though, Justin. Right. And then as we talked further and I described to him my trend following program/system that I was running at the time, at the end of it all, and we had a long and interesting discussion. He said, "You know what I'm going to do?" He said, "I'm impressed with what you've told me," because I meet a lot of kind of budding traders and so on, and they usually don't have a plan. They don't know what they're doing. They're just kind of trying out this, trying out that. He said, "But you've got a plan and you've got a process and you follow it properly and it makes logical sense. And so I'm going to do what I never do, which is give you a tip." I was like, "Really? You give tips?" He's like, "I never give tips because it's unprofessional." But he said,
"There we are." He never gives tips. It was 10 years ago. Wow.
All right, hold on.
Meanwhile, he drove home in a Bentley and you go on your bike.
He said, "There's this company. I've invested heavily in it for my fund. And I think, this is off the top of my head, I'd have to go and check, but I think they were Ceres Power. Was it Ceres Power or something else?"
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, I'm not 100% sure it was Ceres Power. I'd have to look it up. But anyway, point is, he says this company, no, it probably wasn't. He says this company, you know, I know them really well. I know the management really well. I've had many meetings with them. They really know what they're doing. I love their plan. The price is heading in the right direction. You know, this is my tip. You should buy them. And I was like, okay, well, that's, you know, that's as good as it gets, right? From the insiders. He knows them personally. So I went out, I bought the stock. I watched the stock. About a month later, I'm still watching the stock. And it starts doing something a bit odd. It stops doing that two steps up, one step down. It starts kind of forming what looked like a rounding top. And then it starts kind of sliding. And this happened over a period of days and then a period of weeks. I held on to it for longer than I probably should have because I was, you know, sort of had trust in that guy. He knew what he was talking about. And then basically one day it breached all the technical levels. It looked wrong on the chart. It looked like a downtrend had begun, like a proper downtrend. So I sold it. I just thought, sod it. I'm just going to sell it. I sold it. And the very next day, it absolutely plummeted. It crashed. It collapsed. A bad piece of news came out, and that was it. It was on its knees.
Yeah, hang on a sec. So, yeah, but if you look,
and I checked, first of all, he was still holding it.
Yeah, so hang on.
Lying to me,
Glenn. Glenn. You said earlier you can get inside information. Insiders selling. So first of all, he didn't sell. Secondly, Ceres Power, right? Has been I think it probably was because it kept the market with a lot of hype, right? It went up to like 40 quid and then came down to like £1, right? That was in 2011, so that was 10 years ago. That was £1, right? Now it's 10 quid. So the timing was out, but there was no insider selling. What are you talking about there? I mean, you said there's insider selling. No, technically.
Oh, that's when it was. Yes. In fact, it was more than 10 years ago. Yeah, it was more like around about 2007 because it was going crazy in 2007.
But if you'd looked at certain filters, you went on a tip based on nothing, and literally, of course, they're not going to pay it. That's what I'm saying. But investing is about researching. Tips are not researching, are they?
No, but it's not the point. The point is
exactly the point. You just said insider selling. You said insider selling.
He did incredible amounts of research, as in actually getting to know the management.
Well, he's an imbecile.
Having loads of meetings
with them. Who is this imbecile? He's an imbecile.
He was a top fund manager.
He can't be that good if he'd piled loads of money into it. It's pre-revenue.
It doesn't matter if the price is £10 now, because did you see what the price fell to? Right.
What were they turning over then? What was the revenue
after
there?
I sold it, if it was Ceres, and I think, it, as you say, it probably was. I sold it around about, by the looks of this chart, I would have sold it around about £27.
What was the revenue there?
Revenue? £27. Over the next few years, after I sold it...
You're ignoring the fundamentals.
The price fell to 12p.
I know, but you're ignoring the
pounds Glenn, to 12p. That's
Glenn.
Called losing almost all your investment. Well, it is losing all your investment, basically, isn't
Glenn,
it?
Glenn, let me ask you a question. Did you do any research, Bob, and look at the chart? Because if you'd done some research, you probably would have invested in it.
I looked at the fundamentals and I found that they were as excellent as he told me that they were.
Well, so how much were turning over there? What was the valuation?
It was bloody years ago, but the point is he knew his stuff.
So basically,
I knew my stuff.
You went to a party, you got a tip, didn't pay off. That's not investing.
You're not picking up the...
Well, anyway, let's talk about crypto. Right. No, you're trader's bias.
It's not a trader's bias.
I wouldn't have bought into that.
Even somebody who really knows
I wouldn't have bought into that. There's no revenue.
You still get it totally wrong because unless you're the actual chief executive of a company, you don't really know what's happening.
That idiot should not have been a fund manager. He's obviously an imbecile. And you getting a tip off him, basically, and buying into it, even worse. That's not investing. Anyway, let's talk about Bitcoin.
The price is still far, far lower than it was 10, 15 years ago when I owned the thing. So I'm bloody glad I sold it.
Yeah, if you researched that, you would never invest in it. You took a tip.
Oh, you're so annoying because you're just talking rubbish.
Basically took a... No, Glenn, you took a tip.
You just said you
took a tip off a guy in a party.
Yeah, but he wasn't just any guy, was
Doesn't
he?
Matter. It was a tip. Off a guy in a party 10 years ago.
It was as good a tip as there exists in the world.
I rest my case, Your Honour. Thank you very much. No more questions.
You're just silly.
Right.
Just a silly man.
Let's talk about Bitcoin. Again, traders
buy. There is a lot to say about Bitcoin. We've only left ourselves 10 minutes to talk about it.
Okay, so
all right.
For a while, do you know what I said a while back? Didn't I? We said when it basically hits, when it crosses over 200-day moving average, generally, two out of the last three times it's done that, it's gone lower and it's been lower a year later. And you can discount the third time because that was the pandemic dash for cash crash that happened when everything sold off. So that was not based on specifically Bitcoins. But the other two times it's gone over the 200-day moving average. It's been lower a year later. And we had a little rally. It's happening again right now. It's rolling over a little bit. But what's... The news came out. What was it about the FBI or something there? What's going on with the FBI?
Yeah, I think the FBI thing is actually what triggered this fall last night because the news came out at almost exactly the same time. So I think it triggered the slide. But of course, if you look at the chart, you'll see that, you know, it's been on the edge of a slide for many days now anyway. We talked about the sort of the triangular pattern that was forming in the chart, and it sort of presaged this decline that started last night. So we were sort of half expecting it. Anyway, point is, the Justice Department in the US recovered $2.3 million in cryptocurrency that was a ransom paid by Colonial Pipeline Company. They had basically been hacked. It was supposedly the most disruptive US cyber attack on record. Colonial Pipeline had its systems hacked, which led to massive shortages in petrol, because that's the pipeline that it has, a petrol pipeline, so an oil pipeline. So massive shortages at gas stations on the East Coast of America. So quite a big deal. And they paid a ransom, right? About $5 million. Mm-hmm. They haven't got all of that back, but they've got quite a lot of it. And what's interesting is that I assumed that it was simply a case of Bitcoin being trackable, as we have talked about many times before, that actually Bitcoin isn't anywhere near as anonymous as some people seem to think it is, because you can track the transactions that occur on the Bitcoin network. So, for example, when Colonial Pipeline had $5 million transferred to them in ransom money, you can see anybody, including me, can watch that money be transferred from one wallet to another over the internet. I can watch it on various websites. And then you can watch it being transferred from website to from wallet to wallet, which is makes it very easy for the justice system to track it. The problem is gaining access to the wallet is a different kettle of fish altogether, because you need the passwords, you need the private keys. Somehow the FBI got hold of the private key for the main wallet that had most of the money in it, not all the money, but most of the ransom money, and they've now seized it. The question is, how did they get that private key? That's like getting the password to your email account or something like that. Like, how on earth did they do that? They haven't said.
So well, I know how they did it. They basically got one of the guys in charge of it and say, listen, mate, you're going down for 2,000 years unless you grasp up everyone else.
Maybe, but the problem is the entire hacking group is in Russia, and there's absolutely no question. And in fact, even the vice president of a cybersecurity firm is quoted by Reuters as saying, prosecution is a pipe dream. You know, it's out of the question that any Russian hackers would be prosecuted. The Russian authorities would, of course, never cooperate with such a thing. So the question is there somebody, did they maybe have an American contact, perhaps, who the FBI managed to get to and threaten in the way that you just described? Maybe that's how they did it.
I think they waterboarded them. They basically tortured them. That's what they did. Torture, waterboard, all that kind of, all the techniques. That's how you do it. Surely, how else would they get how else do they hack unless they've got hackers hacking the private key somewhere? I don't understand. It's got to be that, isn't it? Torture.
I don't know. I've
good old, no idea. Good old fashioned torture.
Good. It always worked it always worked in the past, didn't it? For John le Carré. Yeah. So the question is, is this the beginning of a longer slide? Because it was only a small slide last night, from about $35,000 in the price of Bitcoin to about $32,500 or $33,000. So in Bitcoin terms, that is nothing. It's a tiny blip. But
now,
it's already
now
part
50%
of the sort
of
ongoing slide.
We're now 50% down from the high.
From the highs, which is why I'm no longer invested or trading in it right now. Exactly. I sold out near the top, you may remember. So I've saved myself a 50% or so drop, which is nice. Mm-hmm. But the question is, when to get back in? Is this the beginning of a much wider slide, a longer slide that will lead to a proper bear market? Or is this just a correction in the bull market that started late last year? I'd say the jury's still out on that one. I'm not decided either way.
Yeah, we've had two examples here of, two negative bits of press. I suppose the second one was Trump saying, in his inimitable style, saying, I don't like Bitcoin. It seems like a scam. You know, I don't like it because it's another currency competing against the dollar. So that's why it's a scam, he's saying. So, he wants the dollar to be the currency of the world. And yet Bitcoin is obviously, to me, the fact that he's worried that the Bitcoin threatens the dollar says a lot, doesn't it, about the power of Bitcoin, you know?
Yes, it does. I mean, he first said it was about a year or two ago. He said something similar in a tweet about, I hate Bitcoin and it will never replace the US dollar. Never, never, never. But it's interesting that he's now come out and said it again, because it shows that Bitcoin is back in the public eye, and it's something that even a former president is somewhat worried about, sees as a threat. It's also interesting to look at how the news has flipped, I've noticed. If you just search Bitcoin on Google News, for example, it's all just bad news, bad news, bad news now. Mm. Whereas, like, a few weeks ago, when the price was doing well, it was all good news, good news, good news. Like, do you remember how the stories were also positive?
Yeah, yeah, but that's also negative. This is confirmation bias. I often say this. It happens with share prices as well, and companies. I've done podcasts with friends on the weekend, and share price has gone down, a couple have been negative. I said, well, hang on, look at the last update. It's fine. The market's having a bit of sell-off. That happens. The market's happened. So you've got to have confidence in your research sometimes, and conviction. If you're an investor, this is. And that can happen all the time. And then share price goes up, and everyone then focus on the positive news from the company. You think, well, hang on a sec. Yeah, when the share price is going down, you're very negative about this company. So, and some people sell out on that negativity. And that's the problem with investing. It's largely mental. You know, it's largely a psychological game.
It is. It's totally mental.
You know, unless you're completely overexposed and going nuts, if you believe in a company, you've looked at it and researched it, and the operation's getting better, financially they're getting better, everything's just going the right direction, the market will have ups and downs, the volatility. Don't let, the share price affect your perception of the business, because it happens whenever you have sell-offs. Look at all the news channels, CNBC, all the financial news channels, they play into the narrative of the negative sentiment, and that makes people worried, and all of a sudden stock market rise again, hitting new highs, all of a sudden they're still with positive things and they're playing into the positive set. It's like, sometimes it's all noise. It's noise.
Yeah, it is noise. Just as an example, the Financial Times has just got an article I noticed today called "Bitcoin Lacks a Solid Foundation as an International Currency." The writer is associate professor at the Research Institute of Industrial Economics. What's not interesting is that article, because I've read a million articles exactly like it. But what is interesting is the fact that they've chosen to print it now. As you say, it's kind of an example of it's a peer pressure kind of thing, isn't it? When Bitcoin price is absolutely soaring, commissioning editors at newspapers, I guess, are less likely to commission negative articles like that because they don't want to kind of look like they're out of touch with people. You know, if everybody's like loves Bitcoin, they don't want to print an article that goes, "Oh, it's all a load of old rubbish," because it makes them look like old fuddy-duddies, right? Mm-hmm. But then when the price starts sliding, they regain their confidence in their fuddy-duddiness, and they start printing articles like crazy, going, "Oh, it's a load of modern rubbish," and so then you get all of that coming out at the same time. But as you say, once the price recovers, whenever that happens to be, then no doubt they'll be too scared to print most of those articles. Most of it will all be positive news again.
Yeah, but if you look at what was your rule on it, was it the 20-day and the 50-day moving average? Was that the one you were saying before?
I think, that was one that I put in my book. I mean,
I generally think that's a trend-following system. If you want to, rabbit ears there, invest in Bitcoin, I'd honestly wait until the it may have big rallies and sell days, but if you want to see an uptrend, that is a good thing to look at. 20-day cross and 50-day, again, at some point, that's a good thing to look at. That means
it is.
The price stopped falling. It's gone sideways for a while. The moving averages have flattened out, and then it'll rally up. And just look at the basic moving averages. I mean, if you look at the 20-day, the 50-day, and the 200-day, those are basically trends. That's moving averages. They're based on the price action. And so at the moment, 200-day, 20 days crossed, not only the 50-day, but the 200-day. And that hasn't happened for a long time. And that is not a good sign. So when that happens, generally, you'd have a sideways action or downward action for a while. So you've got plenty of time. I think it was the first time that happened, in the first crash a while back. It was like a year before that recrossed again. So it's worth...
It is a worry. It's a...
I'm not saying it's all down
there. This does have the makings of a proper crash, one that lasts for a long time. The only thing that gives me pause, I suppose, is that it's playing out reasonably fast this time. I don't know. I guess my instinct is kind of telling me that this doesn't feel like late 2017, early 2018, not yet anyway. I was pretty certain back then that it was the end. And, I was going to speaking at cryptocurrency conferences in early 2018, and all the questions were like, it'll be recovered within a month or so, yeah? And I was going, no, we're talking years here. And this is on, by the way, that was recorded, so I can even phone you a video recording to prove I said that. I reckon this will be years before it recovers. But I don't get that feeling this time somehow. Maybe I'm wrong, but it's only a silly instinct rather than anything scientific. But it's kind of telling me, I think it will recover sooner rather than later.
All you can look at, in my view, with chance-wise, is probability of something happening, if it's happened before. And if we look at the previous high the Bitcoin made, and that was, in 2017, where it hit close to $20,000, and then it started rolling over because the same kind of level of hodl and all that sort of crazy herd mentality was in, sort of blinded by the fact that it could go down. They wouldn't, no chance of it ever going down, and it hit a high, and people think it was going to the moon. So it hit 20,000, then it started dropping, rapidly. It took a while though, some big rallies, and people thought, oh, here we go. But if you use almost the 20-day against the 200-day, it crossed down literally at 9,000. So we're at 20,000, 9,000, and then didn't cross back up. Let me scroll back. That was in 22nd of March 2018. It crossed down, and it didn't cross back up the 200-day until April of the following year. So it's a year, and it had one big day where the price went through the 200-day moving average, and then a few days later, the 20-day moving average crossed above the 200-day moving average. Then, and then it went from 4,500, so it dropped a lot, 4,500 up to 14,000. And then it went sideways pretty much, and then the pandemic crashed again. But that was a pandemic. So, yeah, I mean, that's a trend following system. It's good. I mean, it's having the patience, isn't it? It's when you see these big updates and, oh, no, the
trend. I've got the patience, man. Yeah. I've got that patience. So, long-term trend following pays off. It always has. But
are you in any cryptos?
A little, yeah. A little bit, but not much. I'm pretty much, I sold out of nearly everything near the top, not just Bitcoin. I sold out of virtually everything, or not virtually everything, but most of the stuff I had. And I've still got, you see, the thing is, there are some cryptos that are still looking a little bit positive. And this is partly what gives me pause. Like Ethereum is still looking kind of bullish on the chart. It doesn't really look bearish. It doesn't look entirely bullish, but it doesn't look bad like Bitcoin does. There are other ones, Cardano, ADA, which is still sort of looking vaguely bullish as well. Dogecoin is still not looking anywhere near as bearish as it probably should. That's Elon Musk's favorite one. Back to the Bitcoin chart, though, I think it's worth mentioning that we're near to kind of key support levels now, right? The price is oscillating around the same levels that it was oscillating around back in January. Now, if it breaks down below that, we're talking around about $30,000. If it breaks down below that, which it may well do by the looks of it, then what's the opposite of the sky's the limit? The ground's the limit. It could fall significantly further after that because there'll be no strong support, no strong buying pressure for a while. You're looking at targets of kind of $20,000 or even lower as possibilities. So even though I'm saying I don't think this will be a full bull market as in lasting years, I'm certainly not ruling out the possibility of the price halving again from this point before it recovers. So I'm not saying it's going to recover from this point. I'm just saying this whole thing feels quite quick, like this correction might be quite short-lived, even if it's deep.
What about the fundamental support of El Salvador?
Oh, yeah, we must mention that before I go. El Salvador has decided that it's going to become the first country to use Bitcoin as legal tender under the president's plan. To be honest, I think it's just a PR stunt. I don't take it too seriously. Okay, it's useful if it's legal tender in the sense that people will be able to more easily transfer remittances from abroad. It's very important to developing countries like El Salvador to get remittances from citizens who live abroad in places like America. They earn their money there and then they transfer it to their relatives, and it can be easier and cheaper to transfer it in Bitcoin rather than in dollars, which is one of the main use cases of Bitcoin. Of course, actually turning Bitcoin into a legal tender, I think that's not strictly necessary at this point, because was he saying that people are going to start using it as regular currency even though the price of it fluctuates ridiculously from one day to the next? Really? Is that a sensible thing to be encouraging? I don't think he really knows what he's talking about here or what he's doing. He's just somebody suggested it to him. He's like, yeah, that'll be really cool. This is a guy who wears a baseball cap, the president. So it's like he likes things to be really cool.
You can't be a currency when it's this volatile. Because that is just like a banana republic currency. It just, it's going up and down like a maniac yo-yo. It's got to stabilize. I don't know how it does that. I think because there's so many whales holding so many Bitcoin at the start, they can dump some and it just goes down and then the sentiment goes down. So it just needs, like gold, for example. Gold's a lot more boring, but it's a bit more stable, and that's why, people can hold it a bit. But like Bitcoin, it needs to be, making decent percentage returns a year, not triple digit, because you know then you get the volatility and it can't be currency. You know, don't just spend Bitcoin when it's that volatile. If there's a chance
I think this is a sideshow, and that the main kind of narrative around Bitcoin and the reason its price remains relatively high is because people see it as digital gold. That's the narrative. The narrative is that we're in a world, an inflationary world now. All the central banks are printing loads of money. They're all pretending that inflation isn't taking off, but we all know it is taking off because we see it in the prices of goods and services, and they try and fool us with the figures. It makes CPI look artificially low or whatever, and it's, you know, by messing around with the metric and or the basket, and it's, you know, it's not good enough. We all know that pounds and dollars in bank accounts are being kind of eaten away by inflation over time, and so as a result people want an asset that they think will appreciate over time. Gold is doing well again, or better anyway, and Bitcoin has been doing well until a couple of weeks ago. So that hasn't changed. People are still looking for places to put their money where they hope they will get some kind of return. And that's the use case for Bitcoin at the moment, really. Mm-hmm. That it's not correlated to other assets. That's kind of the main point, I suppose.
Yeah, because let's be honest, if you are in El Salvador and you know, let's say you owe someone, you know, you want to buy a house for $30,000, so you give them one Bitcoin, and then a year later, Bitcoin $60,000. Think, oh, hang on a sec, I shouldn't have used my Bitcoin to buy that house because it'd been worth $60,000 now. I've pretty much lost $30,000 in a month. So you can't. You need something stable. That's not going to work, is it? So I think
remittances, because obviously, you know, if you're an El Salvadorian citizen living in America, you've just earned your pay packet for this week in dollars. You can then quickly transfer. You know, you stick it in your bank account, or indeed in a sort of, you know, some other. If you don't have a bank account, there are other ways to transfer your money into Bitcoin. You transfer it into Bitcoin, and then you quickly send it to your relatives, and then they transfer it into either a local currency or back into US dollars at the El Salvador end of things. So the point is, by doing that, you don't actually have your money sitting in Bitcoin for more than even a few minutes necessarily, like as little as half an hour, so which isn't a great currency risk. But you don't, as you say, if you wouldn't want to keep it in there for even a matter of days, because the price could change so dramatically. So you can see it as an investment, as many people do, or as a trade, as some naughty, dirty people do. But what you don't want to see it as legal tender right now.
Look at that. Oddly, I just saw a tweet there, right? And it could be related to this, but I just saw a tweet from, who is this? This is from First Squawk. Multiple websites are now down, including UK government websites, CNN, New York Times, Guardian, FT, Spectator, and many other websites, all down. Really?
What?
I know.
What the hell? Well, wow. Gov.uk. Oh my God, yeah, gov.uk is down. Oh dear, what the hell's happening?
They're probably asking. They get some ransomware now, and they want Bitcoin as payment.
Are we podcasting the end of the world live on Vox Markets here? This is a bit scary.
Yeah, there we are. So I think if anything, I think this will be bullish for Bitcoin. If you can't trust anything else, trust Bitcoin.
The end of the world is always good for Bitcoin, I'm sure. Yeah. In fact, it's actually risen a little bit in the time that we've been speaking. I wonder if that's due to that. Yeah. Who knows?
Marvellous stuff. Glenn, thanks for that. And remember, you know, don't be a dirty trader, okay?
I'll always be dirty.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Kodal Minerals, up 32%, 0.32. At four, Challenger Energy Group, down 3%, 2.65. At three, Hemogenix Pharmaceuticals, up 2.3%, 1.975. At two, Nightcap, up 6.5%, 24.5. And at one, Net Scientific, up again, 24% to 181, had an excellent run in the last couple of days due to that hookup collaboration with AstraZeneca, of course. Okay, it's time for the top five most read RNSs. They are as follows. At five, Zephyr Energy, pledged to achieve 100% carbon neutral operations. At four, Itaconix, trading update. At 3, On the Market, full year results to the 31st of January. At 2, Codal Minerals, Begoni Lithium Project Mining License Update. And at 1, Omega Diagnostics, Regulatory Progress for Visitect COVID-19 Test. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.